Hey guys, you're listening to Snacks and Chats. It's actually a pretty serious podcast that just has a silly name. We basically interview a bunch of creative, interesting people, and generally we begin the interview with the question, when people ask you where you're from, what do you tell them? And that's because I find that what people's answer to that question is generally says a lot about their life experiences and how they feel society views them. So, hope you enjoy.
Good afternoon.
Let's go. Hello.
Good morning. Could be night.
Could be any time, except we've got the doors wide open, so you can probably hear the cicadas through the mics.
What does that mean? It's definitely a time in which cicadas talk.
So, narrow it down.
We have our first international guest today, actually, on Snacks and Chats. Omar bin Musa.
That's me.
Correct or incorrect?
Correct. Also known as the OBM. Also known as ASAP Luxa. Kendrick Lamar. The Borneo Romeo. Hey, the siren comes in right on time.
The AKAs of this man.
Poet, writer, rapper. Am I missing out any other slashes there?
Screenwriter? Scallywag? Scapegrace?
What does scapegrace mean?
Scallywag, troublemaker.
Right. Thesaurus.
Yeah, pretty walking thesaurus.
All right. Sup, Omar. So I'll start from the basis of this podcast. When people ask you where you're from, what do you tell them?
I guess it depends on where I am. But most of the time I say that I'm Malaysian Australian, because I think oftentimes there are these rigid ideas of nationality and identity that are projected onto us, especially in Australia, you know, where people are so divided, like into sort of us and them, the us usually being what is considered the epicenter of Australian society by a lot of people, which is like an Anglo-Australian kind of Christian experience, and being like Muslim Australian or Asian Australian, I've always felt like I was defined as being kind of on the outside of that. But then I started to think, what's wrong with being kind of a hybrid identity or like a liminal identity or something like that? Yes, Malaysian Australian doesn't encapsulate everything that I am, but I really like that hyphen in between. Some people don't like it. Some people see it as kind of, I don't know, reductive, but I don't see it like that. I see it as enriching, and it's kind of that hyphen that I'm interested in, that sort of in-between space. Because so many of us in this world, even if you are Anglo-Australian, you inhabit some type of liminal kind of space as well. So I claim that when I say I'm Malaysian Australian.
Right. And it's not for any other reason. It's not like because you feel like you have to explain yourself.
Possibly. I think because, I mean, I've listened to this podcast a few times, and a lot of times people have to explain where they're really from.
Yeah.
And so I sort of jumped the gun with that, and I'm like, I already know what you're going to ask.
Yeah.
Where are my parents from? My dad's from Malaysia. But then I'll always make the point of also putting my mother into that, who is white Australian, but I always say she is Irish Australian. So I force her into inhabiting that liminal space as well. So that why is it just us who are kind of brown or ethnic or people of colour? Why do we always have to, you know, explain that? So they might have to as well. So it hopefully puts us all on a bit more of an equal playing field, even if we're not, but just sort of theoretically, I guess. And then, yeah, I guess internationally when I'm outside of Australia, I like to define myself by saying that as well, so that it gives a different projection of what it means to be Australian. Because a lot of people say in America are surprised when they meet me and they're like, oh, you're Australian. I thought Australians all had blonde hair and surfed on Bondi Beach, blah, blah. And so I kind of, again, want to show that different facet, that no, we've got people of all different backgrounds in Australia. And I'm proud of my Asian heritage. I think weirdly in the public eye, oftentimes I've been cast as the Muslim Australian. And although I was raised as a very strict Muslim, now I'm quite lapsed as I sit here sipping on my Heineken with you guys. You know, I define myself as a secular Muslim. But a lot of people find this a weird thing to say, a lot of Muslim people included. But I would say I define myself more by my Asianness and my connection to the Southeast Asian region and my heritage in that way, as opposed to religion.
Right, gotcha. When you were growing up, I mean, you talk about this on your album Since Ali Died. You talk about that experience of growing up brown in Australia.
Yeah.
So not particularly pleasant for you.
Yeah, a lot of the time it wasn't, because as I said, you know, there's that white Anglo experience kind of seen as very central to being Australian, and if you don't measure up to that, then you're not legitimate. You're not authentically Australian, which is such a bizarre thing considering that it is black land that we live on. It's Aboriginal land, you know, but white people have kind of indigenized their presence now in Australia, where they often feel like they are the rightful owners and custodians of the land and of the culture. And if you don't measure up in every aspect, then you're not legitimately Australian. And so, yeah, I mean, I experienced racism all the time growing up, feelings of being the outsider, and that can have more of an impact on you than you realize. And so you grow up, even if you claim that proudly and you say, sure, all right, I'm on the margins, I will claim that outsider status. In some ways, there is a lot of, I think trauma is too much of a word to say, but a lot of emotional labor that you've expended and pain by doing that, even if you're standing up or standing in opposition to that kind of racism. Yeah. It's hard work.
Yeah. Mm.
It is hard work. And if just by your very name, you are cast into the position, say, in a post 9/11 world of being the terrorist or the enemy. And when you are a young guy watching the news and you start hearing about the enemy, and then you realize, oh my God, they're also talking about me.
Yeah.
That's a pretty disillusioning thing to think about and to learn about. And it makes you, it can make some people feel very disenfranchised and lost and melancholy. Made me feel very angry, a mixture of melancholy and angry.
Did you notice a big change around when 9/11 happened and the way people would react to you and treat you?
Oh, definitely.
You and stuff? Yeah.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, just being brown and being like Asian Australian, except looking to a lot of people like I was Pacific Islander or Aboriginal or Lebanese or whatever the hell people wanted me to be, it seems. I'm like a cultural chameleon in that way. So people would often project their insecurities or prejudices onto me. But there was sort of a nebulous feeling of feeling sort of on the outside and experiencing this racism and being told to go back to where you come from, but they didn't really know where that was. And but then it became really, really pointed after 9/11, where it was just like, yes, you are demonized, you are dehumanized, you are reduced to this kind of stereotype of a terrorist and the type of person we don't want in this country, even though I was born there. I speak English better than half of the trolls who attack me. Well, let's say 98% of them probably. but that doesn't matter. To them, you're just you're an animalistic kind of, like something demonic, really, and something to be hated and rejected. And that's a huge thing to come to terms with.
Yeah, and how do you come to terms with that, and how do you... I mean, it's very heavy, you know, when you talk about that, the weight of that, it's very heavy to walk around with day to day, right? And that is your home country.
Yeah, well, I choose to be fierce and ferocious and fearless and rebellious in the face of all of that. You know, I think there are some people, and I understand oftentimes people feel like they have to assimilate to survive and sort of play by the rules.
The model
minority.
Yeah.
The respectable migrant, the respectable citizen. But I feel like if I'm going to have equity and equality in terms of my voice as a citizen that is equal to them, then I'm allowed to act up as much as they're allowed to act up. And I'm allowed to stand up and confront them. And also, being the model minority, it doesn't work. Being respectable doesn't work. You can be as nice and polite as you want to be. But in the end, if you step out of line once, they're baying for your blood. You know, so why even bother? So there were certain things, especially even recently, that were instructive in terms of that. You know, there was Lady Yasmin Abdel-Majid, who I think you might have heard of, who is a Sudanese-Australian writer and engineer, very accomplished, very friendly, vivacious, smiley woman, you know, wears a hijab as well. But, you know, she was sort of seen as this beautiful beacon, and I think to a lot of people, maybe projecting this on her, a model Muslim. But as soon as she kind of criticised the nationalist discourse of Australia and spoke about...
Nauru
and Manus Island, and sort of said basically, lest we forget on Anzac Day, lest we forget these places, these black spots in Australian consciousness where huge crimes are being enacted against people in our name, you know, she was torn down. People were trying to... Really, it looked like almost drive her to suicide, and they drove her away from the country. She now lives in London, you know. And so I think to a lot of us, we deep down knew this, but it was instructive. It was just like, well, why even bother? If I'm going to get attacked and shouted down, then it might as well be for the right thing and asking the right questions and being a dissident and being rebellious. And so, I don't know, I've always been kind of like that anyway, like from a young age. But I think a lot more people are coming around to that point of view. They want to live on their own terms. It's hard to do because that weight that you talk about and that weight is coming from the people around you. It's coming from history and it's coming from the media. These are huge forces and we're sort of being buffeted in between. But, you know, we're just trying our best to sort of question that. And there's this famous quote by Bertolt Brecht, this German poet and playwright, and he says, "There was little we could do, but without us, the leaders would have felt more secure." And I kind of follow that idea. I follow that quote. What I'm doing feels like I'm waging a losing war most of the time. It's very meager. You know, I'm making art. I'm making poems. I'm making songs. But it's something. You know, it's something that challenges the status quo, and it's something that might provide some relief to a kid like me who was growing up feeling lost and could have internalized that hatred and could have felt disempowered. Maybe I give them a bit more bravery and then they do that for someone else.
Like you say, it's been with you since you were a kid, like that attitude. Where are the seeds of that? Like, who helped you become that?
I think a lot of it came from my mother. I don't think I've ever thought about it like this or spoken about it like this, but my mother is very rebellious. She stands up to authority and she's very proud of being Irish Australian as opposed to Anglo Australian. You know, now she would be seen as just a white Australian. They're all white Australians. But I think a lot of people of her generation were like, no, we're anti, you know, anti-British, we're Irish. We would stand up to them. And so she would always instill it in me that, you know, it was really important to stand up to authority, to question everything, to question quote-unquote received knowledge. So weirdly, I probably got more of that from my mother than my father, who often was like, no, I think you've just kind of got to accept the way things are and kind of just put one foot in front of the other.
Mm.
Yeah, and just sort of live and survive. Although he did say to me from a really young age, you will have to work harder. You will have to be better. Than a white kid to make it in Australia, and so I kind of definitely internalized that from a young age. But then, just by chance, I'll tell you a story. I spoke about this on the album, but there was a kid at my school when I was probably like, I don't know, 9 years old, and there was this guy in the year above me who actually happened to be the Prime Minister's grandson. So if you figure out how old I am, you could probably Google it and figure out who it is. But he would be super racist to me always in the schoolyard, and he would say these horrendous things, and he would always go on and on about it, and he would say like, oh, your skin is the same colour of shit, and he would use these sort of derogatory terms towards Aboriginal people, but say them about me because, you know, I couldn't tell the difference. And he would say it every day. And eventually one day I went home to my parents in tears and I told them that I wished I wasn't brown anymore. You know, I told them that I wished I was white like the other kids at my school. And my parents tried to sit me down and they sort of said to me, no, you can't think about it like this. You've got to be proud of your skin. Your skin's beautiful. It's brown. And it's golden. And you've got to be proud of being Muslim, even if other people put you down for it, blah, blah. But I don't think it really sunk in. You know, oftentimes it doesn't when your parents are telling you that, because even at that age, you're already starting to take things with a bit of a grain of salt from them, maybe justifiably so. And but then my dad started showing me these tapes, and I don't know if the two things were connected. He started showing me these VHS tapes of this handsome black boxer from America called Muhammad Ali, and he was the prettiest and he was the cockiest and he was a poet. And he had even fought in Malaysia, you know, and it was like, and right. He showed a lot of love to Malaysian people as well. And most importantly, he was Muslim and he was proud of being Muslim. And he said, I'm the prettiest. And I knew even then, I'd figured out he wasn't saying he was the prettiest man alive. He was saying that black was beautiful and being black was beautiful in a world that said it was ugly. And I wasn't black, but I could make the parallel to my own experience. So when this guy said my skin was the same color as dog shit, I suddenly thought of Ali and I said, no, my skin is beautiful and it shines and I'm proud. And he taught me how to be brave and to stand up and then hopefully to stand up for other people who are going through similar types of oppression. So it was really weird. It happened almost just by chance.
Mm-hmm.
My dad showing me this thing. And then it changed the entire course of my life, because then after that, when I was in my early teens, I came across, you know, the autobiography of Malcolm X, civil rights movement in America. I was obsessed with all of that stuff. And then through that, I found out about hip-hop music, you know, because I remember on SBS, our multicultural broadcaster on TV, there was this documentary about the black Muslims. And right at the end, there was this tiny section on the five percenters, you know, it was like an offshoot of the Nation of Islam. And it said that the five percenters had influenced a lot of kind of street culture in New York. And there was this 30-second clip of these two guys jumping up and down on stage, and they were saying this rhythmical type of poetry over a beat. And one of them was like, he had a real deep, like, preacher's voice, kind of like my dad, actually, because my dad was a preacher too. My dad was an imam. And so this one rapper had the hat backwards and this deep voice, and the other one was like this wild dude. He had like gold teeth. He had like a clock around his neck. And and it was Public Enemy. And so, you know, a lot of people lie when they say, how did you come across hip-hop? Oh, yeah, I came, you know, KRS-One or Public Enemy. Yeah. Legitimately, I came across it through Public Enemy. And I just remember thinking at the time, like, wow, these guys are not only influenced by Islam, but they're making the coolest type of music, the coolest type of poetry that I've ever seen. And I knew then that's what I wanted to do.
Did you connect that? Did you, when you listened to it, were you like, this is poetry, or did you think of it as music or as rap?
No,
music?
I thought of it about it as poetry.
Yeah.
Cause so just to sort of double back, my dad had, before he was a religious man, he was a poet and an actor and a romance radio DJ in Malaysia, in Borneo. It was actually through his voice on this romance show that he got access to going to university to study acting, and then met my mum, who was a lecturer at the university. Scandalous.
Ooh, naughty.
Naughty, naughty. And then came to Australia. But my dad would always say to me, like, oh, poetry is a beautiful thing. Poetry is something that you should be doing. It's, you know, the highest of art forms. And so he would say, not only is the Quran written in poetry, but also when I was growing up in the shanty town in Borneo, we had nothing, so we would sit around and just make up all these poems, sort of like freestyling, like they'd make these rhyming poems and toss them back and forth between each other as friends. But also, if you want to holler at a girl, you know, you would, like, you could, like, make her a poem and then she would give you one back. And that's something that has served me very well. And so, yeah, like, my dad was always saying, yeah, poetry is the best when it's spoken, when it's performed, when it's lived. But then I saw nothing like that at school or in Australia until I came across hip-hop music. So I definitely did make that connection, weirdly, in this roundabout way, that this was poetry, and it was the lived type of poetry that my dad was talking about.
And I like how you describe Ali, you know, like, just that confidence. That's very, like, rapper persona.
Oh, yeah. He was, like, the original. He was the proto-rapper.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
And then there is a difference, like, that a lot of people just don't get with rappers, with someone like Ali. If you're of a certain background, the arrogance is, like if you display that kind of cockiness or arrogance, it's kind of more of a stand of resistance. It's different because, you know, you haven't been growing up privileged or entitled to the point where you feel that confidence in your selfhood. Oftentimes you could have internalized that hatred and feel that you really are a piece of shit, or, you know, on the shoe of society. So, you know, when a rapper stands up and says, yeah, I'm the man, like, it's a totally different type of thing from, like, a middle-class white man at a university to be cocky, you know?
Yeah. So what came first for you then? Poetry, rapping, writing, or is it all kind of, there's no separation?
I try not to make too much of a separation, but definitely I'll just say poetry/writing came first, but I didn't know it was poetry. I just always was drawn to it. I liked doing it. I liked stories most of all. You know, I grew up in the flats in Queanbeyan, and I was surrounded by people from all around the world, and we would just sit on the steps of the flats just telling yarns, you know, and that was just inherently fun and entertaining. And so I was an only child, though, so when I went back into the privacy of my own room, I sort of would just write down my thoughts and my little stories
kind
and stuff.
Kind of be alone and just...
Yeah. And it was just, I always thought about it as fun, you know, it wasn't a chore. And I probably do have to thank my parents for that again, but I would just write these thoughts down, And then after a while, you know, my parents and my teachers also, because I'd sometimes show them, I thought it was sort of like a diary, but then they were like, no, you arrange it in a certain pattern, not necessarily rhyming, but you arrange it, use a lot of images, you know, a lot of metaphors and stuff like that. And then they said, actually, this is more sort of like poetry than it is like prose. And then that was kind of my thing. So, you know, a lot of people come across poetry later in life, but I came across it even, you know, when I was in primary school. And then I sort of transferred it later on. Well, this is after high school.
Mm.
I transferred it into poetry and into rhyming. So I don't think I'm actually like a natural rhymer the way that a lot of rappers are. That's sort of something that I've just, you know, obviously had to pick up with hard work and everything. Like, I think the imagery and the story and stuff like that sort of comes first.
Yeah.
But even race-wise, sort of how I got into hip-hop was interesting because, you know, it was in like the late 90s, early 2000s. Australian hip-hop hadn't really flourished or blossomed. It was seen as like patently uncool, which it probably still is over here, I would say, in New Zealand from my chats with Kiwi friends,
yeah.
Which is fine, you know, different strokes. But like, you know, also it seemed to me, and I know a lot of other people felt this way, it seemed really white. So that was one thing that it was like, it wasn't just the accent that people said like, oh, Australian accent sounds stupid rapping. It wasn't necessarily that to me. It was more that I couldn't relate to a lot of the people that I saw who were making Australian hip hop.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of drawn more towards New Zealand hip hop early. I had like my best friend growing up was this guy called Kilifoti, and he was a Samoan Australian guy who, and this is something that goes through my life, he immediately assumed I was the only other Samoan guy at school, so he came up to me. And by the time he figured out I wasn't, it was too late, which also happened with David Dallas. it was years before he found out that I was actually Samoan. And by that time, I'd already sunk my claws into him.
Fuck, now I'm stuck with this guy.
Stuck with this guy. Anyway, but so Foddy, he would like always go to New Zealand to hang out with his family, and he would bring back music.
Yep.
And like, so he would, like, especially King Kapisi, like, I remember thinking this was really cool. And even just because of the front cover of like Savage Thoughts, he's wearing a Lover Lover, but it's like a sarong that I, you know, grew up wearing. So I was like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
And you know, to be honest, it seemed way cooler like than Australian hip hop. And so I kind of was like into that a little bit more. And then obviously into American hip hop, like a lot of people here were, like, you know,
definitely.
Even though it's such a different world, you feel like there are certain commonalities because, yeah, you're experiencing, even to a lesser degree, some of the prejudices that they're going through and all that sort of stuff. And so, and so, yeah, it was just kind of a funny way of getting into it, I guess.
When you wrote it's your only novel, eh? Here Come the Dogs.
Yeah.
When you're talking about all that anger and stuff you felt earlier on in the interview, I was like, oh, yeah, this is it in the book as well, you know? Well, you must have been trying to capture that feeling, right?
Yeah, definitely. That sort of fire and fury and frustration that so many of us grow up feeling. And a lot of people sort of can't understand it or don't want to understand it. You know, it's dismissed sort of immediately, like as if you're just making it up or you're imagining things. And so I wanted to talk about, a generation of young men, oftentimes fatherless, who get into hip-hop music and definitely find some sort of solace and redemption through that music, but it doesn't entirely cure, you know, their fury and their anger. And so that was something I wanted to kind of bring immediately to the page and kind of a world that people hadn't seen before. And, you know, I'm of a generation where I'm kind of part of this sea change in Australian literature where there are definitely have been writers of colour before of great note and skill, particularly a lot of Aboriginal Australian writers. But a lot of us of sort of more migrant backgrounds, I guess, those stories haven't really been told as much. But in the last maybe, even just 10 years or less, there's been so many people of different backgrounds kind of trying to tell stories and bring to light some of these issues. And it's super confronting, I think, for a lot of people. Like, you know, so you get these two different types of responses where there'll be someone who reads it and goes, oh, I see my own life in that. I can totally relate to that. And then another person who's just like, oh, my God, that seems this is happening in Australia. This seems so alien. I didn't even realize. And that's cool. That's what you want.
Yeah, you want people to discover a new world or and that a operates, world, not even a new world, a world that's there but they didn't know about.
A world that has probably been silenced for many, many different reasons and maybe subconsciously silenced. You know, I heard a really cool quote a while ago and it was something about how part of art is extending sympathy where it has not been extended before. And I think that's true. And I think that's what I was trying to do with something like Here Come the Dogs. And there's immense power in that. You know, the type of young men that oftentimes people might cross the street to avoid or move to a different carriage on the train. Why don't we offer them humanity and nuance and not lionize them in any way? Like, definitely look at all their flaws and everything. Mm. But humanize them because they are humans. Yeah. Other people would say it's not our responsibility to humanize these people. It's the onus is upon, you know, an oppressive power structure to go out and find out about these stories. But I think sadly some of the onus is on us. We're humans, you know, and we live through cultural interactions and social interactions. So, you know, there's this kind of weird tension and back and forth.
How difficult was that process of writing a novel?
Oh, man.
I mean I can't, like, I think about writing a book and then I'm like, it would just be about me, you know? Like,
well, a lot of it is. That's the great trick you try to pull, you know? Essentially, a lot of it is so autobiographical or it's different parts of yourself or your imagination or warped sort of projections of yourself. But you try to trick the reader through sleight of hand into thinking that it's many different points of view or many different people. But really, ultimately, it does come back on yourself. Even if you're writing about a really horrendous character, you did the research, you used your imagination, but it was you who did it. I find it a torturous process to write a novel. That's why it's taken, you know, I haven't written another one yet. It's the surefire way to drive yourself to suicide, you know. But, you know, I think there is value in that type of risk, in taking yourself to that place. And when you feel that an artist, it has cost them to create something, even if it's a piece of comedy, there's value in that. You know, I personally
believe. What's the value?
The value is that it takes you into the depths of their soul, into their mind, and hopefully into uncharted territory for yourself. You trek the unmapped path with them, and the things that really matter, matters of life and death and love and hate, things like this, the dark things. I'm drawn towards that. But I am also of the point of view that you learn more from the bad things that happen to you in this life. Tragedy is part of our lives. We all know about the great catastrophe that is coming our way one day, you know, every single person. And we all know that terrible, terrible things and painful things will happen to us and our loved ones. It's how you deal with those things. And so that's why I'm drawn to those things. Because I think they matter and I think they tell us something about ourselves as human beings. And yeah, we can respond in the most resilient and beautiful way as well. It's not all just doom and gloom, but I think you can't shield your eyes from that darkness.
Oh my God.
I sound like bloody, what's his name? Matthew McConaughey from True Detective.
In credits.
Oh my God.
Well, I just want to point out to everyone after that fucking beautiful little spiel, that the first words of the book are, "Where are these cunts?"
Yeah. The greatest opening of any novel in Australian literature.
Where are these cunts?
Where are these cunts? I remember having this funny conversation with my editor and she was like, "Wouldn't it be, where are those cunts?" I was like, where are these cunts? See, I like the idea that it's just like, you know, there's Moby Dick, it's like, "Call me Ishmael." And then there's like, you know, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." And then mine's like, "Yeah, where are these cunts?" Grabs them in.
I think the first I heard about you was David being like, "Oh, I don't like spoken word, but this guy's good."
Oh, cool. I love like that reaction.
It's like a classic David intro, I hate everything, but this guy's all
right. It was a poem called My Generation, and I remember that he like posted about it. He was like, "Oh, you can be pretty moving when you put your mind to it, can't you?" Or something like that.
Always with the real backhanded.
Oh, Jesus.
But I mean, I feel like in terms of recognition or whatever, you're a poet and you're a writer, and I want to know what it is about music and what it is about rap that makes you still go back to that.
Oh man. Yeah, I mean, it is a good question, because it's like, it's so much more expensive for me to do that. Like, to write a novel, yeah, okay, there's your time and everything, and you've got to live and you've got to eat. But for a novel, it's essentially like your brain, a library card, a biro, and a fucking notebook. You know what I mean? Whereas, like, with rapping, I've got to buy the beats and I've got to get mastered and I've got to get mixed and get the studio and everything like that. And so it's just like I'm hemorrhaging money. But it is so fun. That's what it is. It's fun. And it's a different type of energy. It's collaborative, which is the thing I hate about writing a novel is that it's not. It's I'm a sociable person, but then I'm locked in my fucking ivory tower, like with my quill, you know, scribbling away, just going slowly insane. Yeah. Whereas, like, you know, bouncing ideas off other singers and other rappers and the producers especially, I just love that energy. And then the energy of getting on stage is so different. I like spoken word because people kind of hang off every word and they can hear everything you're saying. But then nothing beats that physical energy of jumping up and down. You're sweating, the walls are sweating, people are jumping up and down with you. And then also it crosses language boundaries.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's only so far I can go as a spoken word artist when I go to a country that doesn't speak English. Like, yeah, I choreograph my movements in a certain way and I use my voice in a certain way that can project, you know, some of the feeling of the poetry, but that can't last that long. Whereas, like, if the music's good and the songs are well written, you can go anywhere in the world and they'll get something from it and have fun with it. So there's that part of it for sure. Yeah, it's the sort of communal collaborative aspect mostly though.
I've been listening to this other podcast called And the Writer Is, and there was this quote from Mike Posner, who his quote was, "I had this really deadly cocktail of thinking I was both not good enough but also better than everyone else."
Yeah.
I feel like probably everyone in the world can relate to that.
Oh, yeah.
But it reminded me of when I was reading through your Instagram explanations of each song, it reminded me of that "Palms Around My Neck Like Jewelry, Alternating Links of Pride and Insecurity."
It
reminded me of that Mike Posner.
Best line of the whole album. Thank you for identifying that. definitely. I mean, no writer worth their salt really thinks they're completely in control. No artist either. Mm. That's just bullshit. Like the, you know, the insecurities and the self-consciousness and the self-doubt, it keeps you honest.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't let it cripple you. I know so many people and they just let it cripple them. As Lani is like spilling what beer and water all over herself. Over Jesus.
Jesus Christ.
Cool.
Yeah, you got it. But you have to have that balance, surely. You know what? I'll extend that further, right? And I bet anyone.
But
who's,
do you also think you're better than everyone else? While at the same time of feeling like absolute.
Of course.
Because I feel like that is almost a necessity, almost.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, you have
you know,
to
you
that.
Have to do anything in this world.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why would you do anything?
Well, yeah, and it helps you survive.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, like it's an industry of rejection out there, no matter what the hell you're doing. So sometimes you have to cultivate that sense of invincibility just to get through it all and to get through all the rejections, especially in music, man. It's like constantly, like from when you're younger. No, and also the weird thing is, like with the arts, the higher you go, there's still more and more locked doors, like, and rejections and things like that. It's not like you suddenly get to this point where everyone's just going to give you free rein to do whatever the hell you want. But yeah, I mean, for sure, I think I'm the fiercest, finest lyricist of my generation, without a doubt. But then I don't take umbrage or I don't take it as an offense if someone else thinks that. They should think that.
Yeah, true.
Like, I hate it, especially with like this. It's probably the same here, but like Australian understatement and stuff. And they're like, oh, no, I'm not the best.
We're ultimate. Like, where if you call someone humble, that's the ultimate compliment.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know what's weird though? It's different parts too. It's like I would say that I stay really humble and insecure and full of doubt during the process of creating it. Mm. So I actually have no shame in really backing my work once it's out there, because I know I went through the fire to make it.
Right.
Like, so, like something like Since Ali Died, if you listen to it, it's like I'm pouring my pain and my heartache out there and like really going to those places. And it felt, you know, like it almost, yeah, almost did bring me to some suicidal kind of plane. Like it was crazy. I went through it. And now I'm like, because of that, I have such confidence in what it is and in what I went through to create it, and that that will resonate.
What got you through then? If you were, I mean, you talk about it. You do talk about those suicidal thoughts and those very dark, being in a very dark place on your album.
Yeah.
So what was it that got you through? Or what advice even can you give to people who are going through similar things?
Well, I think oftentimes as artists we make the mistake of saying that the arts or music is kind of like some be-all and end-all type of therapeutic or healing experience. But I don't think that's true. I think it can really help heal you. But, you know, we're lucky enough to live in countries where you can seek professional, professional medical help and mental health advice and help, and I think you should do that because there's like free hotlines and things. So I've done stuff like that, but then I would say overall it was the great bulwarks against the darkness and the madness of life and the and that sort of overwhelming sense of evil you sometimes encounter in the world is music and art and friendship. Like I think those are the two things that got me through in tandem: music and friendship.
Cool.
We're all just trying to dig ourselves out of the muck, aren't we?
Trying.
Seems like a good place to end it, really.
Cheers.
That was good. Yeah, I was meaning to, like, ask you some questions. Just the just hunter becomes the hunted.
Yeah.
That's what you said, but...
I forgot.
Just got two into yourself.
Yeah, I'm just feeling myself. Feeling my hat. Good. Feeling my belt.
Oh, hey, man, you made it to the end. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to Snacks and Chats. If you liked it, tell your friends about it, rate us, and say nice things about us on iTunes, please. Tune in next time. Thank you.